Wise Awards are back for 2024 and early bird entries are still open. These awards recognise the best use of digital media, marketing and commerce, and they also celebrate innovation and expertise right across the digital marketing industry. There are more categories than ever before to enter, so visit exchangewire.com/events to find out more.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to today's MadTech Podcast. My name is Amy Yorterin. I'm an editor at ExchangeWire and I'm pleased to be joined today by Matt Broughton, our research lead. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, Amy. Great to be here.
And Emily Hogan, who works as an independent media consultant.
Hi, Amy. Nice to be here.
Great to have you with us today. So today's conversation will be dominated by streaming. We'll be looking at stories from YouTube, Vox's Tubi that just launched in the UK, and a possible merger for Paramount Plus. So let's get into the stories. To start with, we've got two from YouTube. So YouTube is dominating streaming, making up 9.7% of all viewership on CTV and traditional TV in the US in May. In comparison, Netflix claimed 7.6% of viewership. And then for our second story is YouTube is the top media platform for kids, surpassing video on demand and TikTok. According to research, it's the top platform influencing children's purchases, and they're twice as likely to ask for something they saw advertised on YouTube compared to broadcast TV. So Emily, I'll come to you first. How much of a threat is YouTube to the other players in streaming?
Oh, hi, Amy. Thank you so much. This is a drum I bang quite a lot in my newsletter, The Kids Streamers Fear, that's on Substack. It's YouTube is the stealth. It's the stealth king of streaming, right? And definitely from a kid's point of view, it's the ultimate king. It's been there for years and years and years. There's a couple of key elements to it, right? It's free at the point of view. So it's free for anybody to get on. It's available on any device, essentially, with the internet, right? Like, so it's available on your computer, your smart TV, your phone, anywhere you can want to access it. And you don't have to have a login or any sort of, you know, user interface thing to get on there. So that availability has allowed YouTube to scale so exponentially in the world of video consumption. Obviously, people don't necessarily consider it to be a streamer or in the streaming wars. I think that's sometimes a little bit of a blind spot for people. It's very much there. And what we're seeing now in the US, and this is the US data that's referred to in this article, is that on TVs, like on smart TVs, that YouTube is outstripping Netflix in terms of consumption. So it's no longer just a mobile first or a mobile only platform. It definitely came up and it definitely benefited from that element and that strategy and that pillar still is definitely there, but it's very much a smart TV platform as well, which is fascinating. And I think, you know, from a kid's point of view, we're seeing more and more content, you know, full fact content being published there. You think of Bluey, one of the biggest kids IP at the moment. I know you had Jasmine from BBC Studios on a few weeks ago speaking about it. You can watch 20 plus episodes of Bluey on YouTube without even needing to subscribe to Disney Plus. So, you know, there is a lot of, there's obviously all the user generated stuff, all the influencer stuff, but there is a lot of full fact content on YouTube as well. So it's definitely one to watch in this space. I mean, you need to just, it needs to be a ball you have your eye on if you're in the sphere of streaming, for sure. And definitely for kids.
Yeah, it's definitely a big competitor. There's so much content on there. Yeah. And what do you think, Matt? How much of a threat is YouTube?
Yeah, I completely agree with Emily in the sense that, you know, having such a strong market position in such a fragmented market puts YouTube in a very strong position. Yes, it does sit in that user-generated content niche, and it did dip its toes into that original programming piece, most notably with Cobra Kai, but it withdrew, you know, largely withdrew from that segment. And it's clearly viewing the, you know, the short form user generated content platforms such as TikTok and Instagram Reels as their key growth area, which is why when you go onto YouTube, it's pushing that area so heavily. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's an imminent threat to the other streamers, but in terms of how the likes of Disney Plus are using YouTube, yes, it's very good as a promotional vehicle, but I would recommend exercising caution when going all in on YouTube, simply because we've seen it, you know, with the likes of the other big tech platforms. We've seen the likes of Vice Media and BuzzFeed and how they've struggled in terms of their integrations going over reliant on Facebook and YouTube. So yeah, using it as a promotional tool is a good thing, but don't necessarily over rely on these platforms.
Yeah, the thing for me is that, like, also YouTube it's come up on a social user interface.
Yeah.
Whereas the streaming platforms have come up on what's possibly the most boring interface in the entire world, which is the EPG. I don't know if any of I still have flashbacks of the Sky PowerPoint blue EPG, like whose idea was that, even that color, but like so flat, so boring. And I think streaming, that what you would consider traditional streaming platforms, are really trying to catch up in terms of the tactility of their interface for the user, whereas YouTube is streets ahead. And people might look at it and say, oh, the thumbnails look tacky or whatever, but they work, you know. And streamers, yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Matt, there is a dependency on platforms like YouTube, and I would say TikTok to a certain extent, to help that discoverability point, because they're struggling in that interface, whereas these other platforms have it much more naturally working in a positive way.
Yeah, the UI is a hell of a lot more advanced than the BBC red button from my days.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, very true. So now going a bit further into the second article. So Emily, how significant is YouTube's dominance in terms of viewing and purchasing behaviour among children?
Yeah, this is a report from Precise TV, and it's a free report. I find it really helpful. I definitely have sent it on to a few clients, because it looks at the dominance of YouTube's position versus other streamers. It looks at the dominance of YouTube positions in terms of gaming. It looks at the dominance of YouTube's position in terms of, obviously, linear. And linear is going off into the sunset, but I don't think it will ever leave. It's a bit like radio. There's still a place for linear, definitely, in the kids' TV mix. But that purchasing decision and again, I think it comes down to the user experience on YouTube. Like, advertising is very expected. It's very established. Kids know what they're looking for. You know, when kids are consuming content, they're expecting to see ads when they're consuming YouTube in the YouTube app. Obviously, on the YouTube Kids app, advertising is totally restricted. But the problem with that with kids is that, you know, the YouTube Kids app is limited. And even me, my own child, like, I come up with limitations against it. It's like, oh, I really want to watch that Lego influencer. And it's like, oh, for some reason, it's not on the YouTube Kids app. I'm sure there's some back end reason why he hasn't ticked a box in his video upload or something. But then there becomes this reason to jump into the YouTube main app, which has everything. And it also has advertising. So kids' recall around those ads is strong. I mean, it's that kind of, and I think, you know, advertisers are getting smarter about creating ads for YouTube. I mean, TikTok had that, like, make ads, not TikToks. I think that sums it up, but that can go for every single other platform, to make an ad that's really native to the platform, that doesn't feel too invasive, that doesn't feel, you know, it doesn't feel too addy. It can feel like a piece of content. I think we're seeing the emergence of that, and how to make a good ad on YouTube, you know, make sure that first 5 seconds is really preloaded. And again, Precise TV have a playbook on that as well. So yeah, no, it doesn't surprise me at all. You know, we know kids are watching YouTube the most. The ad recall is, of course, going to be the most, because it's a core platform that they're watching on.
Yeah, it's interesting to see those stats, really, because it really just proves its dominance. Yeah. And so, coming to you now, Matt, at this point, do you think anything could get in the way of YouTube's success?
So I think, in terms of as a platform for that longer form user-generated content, I think it's pretty much unsurpassable at this point. And I think that, you know, having that young user base is so critical for the platform. Obviously, we've seen the likes of, you know, the more legacy social platforms such as Facebook, they're really struggling to, you know, re-engage with that young user base, which is why at the moment, in terms of the advertiser side of things, we're seeing so much interest in YouTube, and also the likes of Roblox, which obviously rolling out more ad products, because they've got this younger audience, which is actually critically being retained. I think in terms of whether anything can get in the way of YouTube's success, I think it's going to come down to regulation. There have been allegations that YouTube is running behaviorally targeted ads against content design for children, which obviously regulators may look into. And obviously, we've got ongoing antitrust action into Google as a whole. That's rightly so, currently covering its ad tech operations. And critically, as of Q1 this year, YouTube is now generating more revenue than the ad tech side of things, the Google Network segment. So obviously, if it was forced to divest of anything, it would probably go more towards that ed tech operations piece, which could still potentially harm YouTube, as it would prevent, currently it's bundling a lot of its inventory into its PMax system, which is obviously can increase the CPMs if they're going for that more video-based content for YouTube. But in terms of as a longer form UGC content platform, it's up there, and I don't think it's going to be shifted from that podium anytime soon.
Yeah, I agree, especially with having that young user base, as you mentioned, is so critical. What do you think, Emily?
I think, I have such a love-hate relationship with YouTube. I love the democratization it offers to content creators. I think that's a wonderful thing. I've been working on the platform for 15 years, and just that ability for anybody to be creative and upload and see success is wonderful. I mean, I think if we're speaking specifically around kids, there's a little bit of a swirling vortex but it's this issue where kids content creators can't monetize on YouTube the way they used to be able to, right? Like, so in terms of it being a really viable business, that is cracking, and definitely for a new content creator coming in now post the kind of the major crackdown on kids advertising in 2019, like building from zero on YouTube for a kids content creator now is really, really, really tough, and finding those monetization pieces. So YouTube they're getting better at acknowledging that kids is such a major part of their user base. They're getting better at trying to service that. I know it's tricky because we see this with lots of platforms. We actually see it with Roblox as well, where they come up with a kids user base, and then they realize monetization is really, really hard. And then they go, la, 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 la. Oh, well, no, but adults, adults are here. Like, forget the kids. You know, it's fine. We're not kids. And kids aren't they try to do this whole shtick, and it's disingenuous because they're like, if you look at the top 30 YouTube channels and look recently, and about a third of them are really, really obviously kids specific. So that's tricky. And it's tricky for what is going to be the next big YouTube kids hit, the next big Cocomelon, like if for new IP coming up, not being able to monetize and build on YouTube in a meaningful way, I think is something that could potentially get a little bit difficult for them. You know, we know we can see with the likes of Cocomelon or whatever, and those kind of YouTube established IPs, kids IPs, that getting onto other platforms is preferable, right? So Cocomelon moved to Netflix and has seen vast success on Netflix, and parents of particularly preschoolers are happier for their kids to be on other platforms other than YouTube, because they don't end up falling down nasty YouTube holes, which I've seen, I've seen myself in my personal life, where, there's a cartoon with a train, a clown with a clown face but the clown face is a balloon, and then the balloon pops and then it's like, I'm dead. And oh my God, it's like the creepiest thing ever. And you're like, oh my God, what is my kid watching? Like, this is so weird. But you don't get that on other established streaming platforms. So there still is this need of kids YouTube creators to get onto those other platforms. And I think that's, again, a little bit of a blind spot for YouTube. I feel like if they were pushed to invest in kids content, or if they were pushed to make the revenue that they're offering to kids content creators a bit more equitable to the usage. Obviously, it's tricky because it's not directly relating to the advertising. That would be something they would need to do in order to kind of continue to stimulate the success of kids IP on that platform. It's a really tricky one there. So that's one thing, at least from a kid's point of view, I can see getting in the way. I'm not saying that they can't just move around it. They probably will and they probably shall, but it is something that I think is going to be tricky, particularly in the next 5 years. And it will be something, talking to Matt's point about policy and regulation, I think that's something that needs to be addressed at a policy level, from the point of view of governments looking at going, what are the children of our nation watching? They're watching YouTube. And what is YouTube doing for the children of our nation? I mean, they had the YouTube Kids Content Fund a few years ago. It was 200 million. which it sounds like a lot of money, but really, like, that's like a coffee to YouTube, like, you know, when they're bringing in like 7 billion a quarter. Yeah. Like, you know, so like, thanks, but you know, that it's, and yeah, that's a lot of money, but a meaningful investment in a long-term run will ensure that you have, you know, again, and it's the right thing to do. That's the other thing with kids. You always want to make sure that we're going to, you know, treat this audience with the care that they deserve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point about there being more risks on YouTube than on some other platforms, definitely. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see kind of how the regulations shape what happens with the platform in the near future, yeah.
Definitely.
So now moving on to our next story, Tubi officially launches in the UK. So the free ad-supported streaming service acquired by Fox is arriving to the UK streaming market. This marks the start of its expansion into Europe, and it will be launching on all major CTV platforms, as well as mobile app and web browser, with a catalogue of over 20,000 films and TV episodes. So coming to you first, Emily, how much of a threat is Tubi to the streamers already established in the UK market?
Tubi is a really interesting one, and it's kind of come under the spotlight, I'd say, in the last year. Obviously, streaming, people can't see me doing inverted commas, wars have been kind of at fever pitch since 2020, absolutely amplified by the pandemic. Everyone's been delulu about Disney Plus, about Paramount Plus, about Peacock, all this kind of stuff. Alongside that, Tubi's been around for a while and it's been building. It has, to me, the same advantage that YouTube has, where it is free at the point of use, right? You don't need to pay anything to access it. And I think when that type of model is deployed strategically and a little bit of special sauce is added, you know, suddenly there's something very, very compelling about, you know, access to the consumer for that. So Tubi's bringing that, and in the US has seen really compelling, steady and consistent gains because of that. And they've been targeting the right segments with it. So younger people, people under 30, that is, underserved demographics like Black and Latina audiences, making sure that they have a content mix that's there. They're not marketing themselves as new content necessarily. I know there are some Tubi originals in the mix, but they're not trying to compete with Netflix and Stranger Things and Bridgerton and all the rest, right? What they're going after is content that can be very, very efficiently priced. So library content, long-running procedural content like NCIS or CSI, you know, those types of procedurals, that's the type of content that they're going after. It's funny because I feel like we kind of, in that fever pitch of streaming wars, there was this focus on prestige streaming output, an obsession nearly with it. And as we've kind of come to a bubble burst on that, where, you know, nobody can literally take any more Marvel shows or we'll all just keel over, you know, like, there has been this return to those more old school shows that have had long runs, things like Suits that popped in the US massively out of nowhere after a decade. And so accessing those types of shows, those types of library shows, is suddenly very in. And I've seen some I've seen some data about Gen Z, and actually when they talk about investing in a show, they don't want to invest. They're worried about investing in Shadow and Bone on Netflix because it might get cancelled. They'd rather invest in something older that they know is going to run for 17 seasons, particularly when it's that comfort TV thing. So those are all the positives of Tubi. Now, as it comes to the UK, it's a different kind of kettle of fish, because UK audiences are far more used to having content accessible free or in a very inexpensive way. Obviously, people pay a license fee, and that supports things like the BBC and ITV and to a certain extent, and Channel 4. So there is a much more competitive market in terms of the free offerings. But, you know, I still think Tubi has a place. I think they're right to be exploring the strategy. I think there's space to be carved. I mean, they sound like they're going very much after the Channel 4 audience, I would say. They're talking about younger audiences. They're talking about underserved communities. And that feels like that's Channel 4's space. I mean, Channel 4, I don't think do that great a job marketing themselves in that sense. And maybe that's something that, like, you know, that they used to be stronger and now it's maybe, they're maybe not as top of mind, because they do have a really great product in 4OD. Like, it's awesome, and there's lots of box sets of stuff and all that kind of stuff. So they offer quite a lot of what Tubi offers. So that's who I see as the main kind of, one of the main competitors. The other thing that is going for Tubi is the usability. So everything I'm hearing about the platform is the usability of it is meant to be brilliant. And again, it's funny because the parallels of this with what we were just talking about YouTube, you know, that user experience, surfacing content, discovering content, the I don't want to say fast channel, but because it's a fast service, but the linear feeds that it provides, the ability to curate those, I think is all something that all of the streamers in the UK should be looking at, and all of the streamers globally, honestly, because I think that's one of the issues of the on-demand only streamers that we have, is that this discovery of content for niches, like smaller audiences. Like if I don't want to watch Bridgerton on Netflix, where do I find what I do want to watch? And that algorithmic acuity isn't there yet. And Tubi seems to be making grounds by understanding that element of its business quite well.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes in the UK, because obviously it's been already running in other places. So yeah, we'll see in comparison how it goes in the UK. Yeah, what do you think, Matt? How could the streaming market be affected by Tubi's entrance?
Yeah, I think it's going to be hugely interesting to see how it translates from the US to the UK, because as Emily suggests, there's so many similarities but also differences within the UK market. And I think the biggest impact will probably be amongst the other free commercial AVOD services. So I think Roku, it's probably going to, you know, affect the likes of those more. As Emily said, UK consumers are generally very, very comfortable with broadcaster services, you know, the likes of iPlayer, ITVX, All4. And they already come pre-installed on most TV sets over here. So it probably won't disrupt things too much there. One place it could disrupt, it could impact subscriber figures to the discounted ad-supported tiers from the likes of Netflix and now Disney Plus. And it could drive those players into keeping either the price low or the ad loads to a minimum, as ultimately users on those platforms, if they're on those ad-supported tiers, they're still paying to view ads, which isn't necessarily a model that UK consumers are very comfortable with. I think Sky's the only other platform where it's a similar model there.
That's a great shout, Matt. That's a really great shout, because that's one of the key differences. Like, this is pure AVOD, whereas that's ad-supported SVOD.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, really good point.
Yeah. So hopefully it'll at the minimum keep those, you know, the prices low on that. But building, you know, Emily, to your point earlier in terms of that diversity of the content it has, I had a quick flick through Tubi's content yesterday, and it has such a wide array of non-Western content. And I think that's going to play hugely well to UK audiences, because the audience here is just so diverse. There's, you know, a whole swathe of Bollywood content, Nollywood films, K-dramas, and it's going to appeal to, you know, the diehard fans of those content, that type of content, and also those having a more casual browse and trying something new. Like, you know, in terms of their Western versus non-Western content, personally I'm more inclined to try out a new Korean drama on there rather than their other content, which includes the 1984 version of Children of the Corn. But it shows that they're slightly more developed. Exactly.
Sell ads by it.
It's a winner there. Like, that's going to be the new suits. But yeah, I think it's also interesting that, you know, Tubi previously pulled out the UK due to concerns over GDPR. Now it's obviously out of the UK, but GDPR is still set to be mostly similar. But I think it's a sensible punt by Tubi, given, you know, before a potential wider European rollout, because I think there's still questions as to how the UK version of GDPR will be enforced. And obviously there's an election going on as we speak, so that may change in the coming years. But yeah, I'm hugely interested to see what kind of position it can carve in the UK, and whether it can make similar inroads here compared to the US.
Yeah, hopefully it will make a positive impact on the UK streaming landscape. That would be great, because we've already got a lot of streaming options. So yeah. Okay, let's move on to our next story. So our final story is about Paramount Plus searching for a streaming partner. So they've been holding discussions with other media and tech companies about the possibility of co-ownership of Paramount Plus. Warner Bros. Discovery has expressed interest in merging its Max streaming service with Paramount Plus. So coming to you first, Matt, how could a partnership of this scale affect the streaming landscape?
I think it's a streaming merger of this kind is probably more reflective of the landscape than one that that actively changes it. I would say, obviously you've got continued inflation, sluggish wage growth, meaning consumers are still being very selective about the number of subscriptions they hold at any one time. And also there's ongoing struggles at Paramount in, specifically at the moment.
Understatement. Are you okay, Paramount?
Exactly. It lost, $500 million in the first quarter alone. It's a bit like, you're not necessarily doing too well. So obviously they are exploring multiple strategic options. It's reportedly offloading its Black Entertainment Television Network. This week it's on again, then off again, now on again, merger between Shari Redstone's National Amusement, which owns Paramount, and Skydance is now back on. Whether that changes the pursuit of the streaming merger, if they get this cash influx, who knows?
It may be back off by the time you're listening to this podcast.
Exactly. Reported Wednesday, off by Friday. But it makes I love a good bit of a on again, off again merger scandal. Whether it impacts these strategies that it's looking at to bolster the monetization of its streaming platform, given it needs a hell of a lot of bolstering, who knows? But I think, if this were to come off, and if, the likes of, I know Warner Brothers Discovery has been mentioned in terms of that merger, I think that kind of merger could pay off initially, and I think there'll be short-term gains from it. But I think it's very difficult to kind of build a distinct brand going forwards, and therefore attract future consumers and bolster the longevity of these platforms if it's merged, because then it'll be a case of, how is Paramount content standing out? Content is still arguably king, so it's a case of how much will it stand out if it's under this merged streamer banner.
Yeah, it's a bit of a complicated situation for them at the moment. They've got a lot going on. Yeah, what do you think, Emily?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with Matt that I think mergers amongst the big global streamers was inevitable. There's so many of them set up, and on the lower side in terms of subscribers, you're talking Paramount Plus, Peacock, Apple TV, particularly ones, in terms of like ones that are established, etc. So I think this was inevitable, and obviously given the tumultuous times at Paramount, it's not surprising that they're potentially looking at this, although it's like, well, just focus on one thing that you need to do to get the company like chin above water, rather than trying to focus on everything and drowning. So a merger of this nature, I think, was inevitable with the mass entrance into direct to consumer of many of the global media companies. I mean, what I would say is Paramount, in my observation, haven't really had a content strategy around their, the crown jewels of their content ever since they launched. And I think that's, when you look at the big players, you kind of go, well, Netflix licensed from everyone and then started building prestige itself. Disney Plus pulled everything out of everybody to have complete exclusivity in a very painful way, I can tell you. And really holds onto its crown jewels very, very tightly in that way. HBO Max had a bit more of a multifaceted approach. Obviously, HBO is such a crown jewel itself. There was, there was mergers, etc., with Turner and all that kind of stuff. So there was more of a journey there, but they have managed to keep a strategy around it. Whereas it felt like Paramount and to a certain extent Peacock were more like, we want to have our own streaming service, but we still want the money from licensing. Oh, what do we do? What do we do? Okay, we'll kind of license and we'll kind of take money, but we'll also maybe make some original stuff that's derived from what we're licensing, and we'll try and just something will work out. But it hasn't been strategic in my view. So, I think, you expect to see Paramount content, the brand affiliation to it isn't necessarily as strong. And secondly, it's on lots of different services. It's on Netflix, it's on Hulu, it's on lots of different services. So that kind of the crown jewels haven't been guarded in that sense. They're, the clarity of what that offering is isn't really there for the consumer, in my view. So, I think what they need is to get clear on how they want to monetize the assets of the business, the content of the business. And from there, they need to kind of double down and stick with it for a period of time, ideally longer than 3 months or 6 months or more like 2 or 3 years, to double down on the strategy in the long term, because that isn't something I've seen them do ever since the streaming war started. They've seemed to be very scattergun about how they approach this, and that's why they are ending up where they are now, with an offering that isn't really clear for the consumer, beyond certain IP and stuff like that. So yeah, that's what I'd see happening. Whether it's HBO Max or not, I think that could be, I mean, that makes sense to me. I think that HBO Max would bring up a lot of the Paramount stuff and it would help solidify HBO's or Max, not HBO Max anymore. It's Max's point, Max's kind of positioning. But it could be equally any of the other streamers, I would say, that it could consider and it would potentially benefit from.
Yeah, those are some good points. You've kind of gone into the, you know, some of the negative aspects there already. So, Matt, what could some of the downsides be just generally for the streaming landscape?
Yeah, so I think obviously, like I said, there's that long-term brand building challenge. It's not, you know, impossible to make that work, I think. But obviously the success cases that do come to mind have either been, you know, the vertically integrated owned properties, you know, the likes of Hulu and ESPN under Disney, or those that cater to a more international audience. So obviously BritBox didn't necessarily take off domestically in the UK, but it's, you know, gone from strength to strength internationally. I also think, you know, potentially longer term, it could lead to reduced competition for original content, which in turn could lead to either, you know, a slightly reduced choice for audience and reduced work for, you know, the writers, the actors, artists, etc., which are already, you know, being squeezed. As we know, we had the, you know, longer term strikes last year and obviously concerns around AI. You know, that it's not out of bounds of imagination to imagine a scenario where, you know, two streamers, if they're merging their streaming operations, they're both trying to hit a particular demographic. They know it's going to end up on the same platform anyway, so it may affect how many of these projects get greenlit. So yeah, there's a couple of concerns there, but to Emily's, you know, circling back on Emily's point earlier, consolidation in such a fragmented market, it is inevitable in these kind of mergers, whether it's just that front-facing brand or whether it's going to be, you know, actually merging the businesses. I think that consolidation is inevitable in such a fragmented market.
Yeah, that makes sense. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how the landscape is in 5 years' time, if it's, you know, reduced competition.
Definitely.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, I think that's a good note for us to finish on. So thanks so much for joining me both. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Amy. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, as always, great to have you as a guest. And thanks so much, Emily, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, guys. It's been fun.
Thanks for being here as our special guest today. And as always, thank you to all of our listeners. See you next time.